de la revolución del mundo.
Justice by any means necessary.
This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2023 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us for Socialism 2024, which will be held in Chicago next Labor Day weekend, August 30th through September 2nd. It's never too early to make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
Okay, so now we are going to get into the meat of it. So the first question for Andrew and Judy is, how has UAWD's presence and organizing changed the functioning of UAW, and in particular, made it more democratic and militant?
Thanks, Nona. Hi, everybody. As Nona said, I'm Andrew Bergman. I'm on the UAWD steering committee. Very excited to be here with all of you today. Can you all hear me?
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. Louder.
Yeah.
I'll just speak louder. Hopefully that'll work. Okay. So I want to start off by just briefly saying, before I jump into this question, I think there's a lot of disagreement right now, actually, in what is the best strategy for a rank and file caucus, even distinctions between rank and file and reform caucuses that are emerging. We can talk about some of those things today. I'm really hopeful that folks here will actually get up to discuss and debate some of these questions. I actually don't think that these things are answered. I think that what we've experienced in the UAW and what UAWD has done was actually very different than the experiences of Teamsters for a Democratic Union, very different to the caucus of rank and file educators. We have some comrades here from Railroad Workers United, different to their experience as well. So I really hope people will get up and sort of weigh in. If you think our strategy's been less than optimal, if you think we did something good that you all wish you had done, it would be awesome to hear about that. So to kind of start getting at this question, about what we've done to change the functioning of the UAW and what our presence has been, I think it's important to actually ask, what is the membership of UAWD look like? And actually maybe even to ask, what does the membership of the UAW look like? So the UAW is actually no longer a majority of Big Three workers. It's about, I think, 150,000 active Big Three workers. Then there's a lot of independent parts and services workers that are still servicing auto. Then there's a bunch of other manufacturing sectors, so especially agricultural implement workers. And then at this point, 25% of the UAW is now higher ed workers. So that's not something that usually people think of when they think of the UAW, but that's what's going on today. As Nona said, I am a higher ed worker that is now applied to get a job in auto, so I'm sort of an odd person in that regard, but I have experiences from higher ed, and then I've gotten to work with these wonderful folks in UAWD, which is predominantly auto workers and is led by auto workers. So the majority of UAWD's membership are actually rank and file auto workers. And there's actually very few amongst those rank and file auto workers that are elected. And I think that looks different than other caucuses. So we don't have a lot of local presidents or a lot of staff or a lot of top leadership, although we have some. Then we've got probably about a third of our caucus is made up of folks from higher ed and legal services. So a little bit more than the sort of percentage in the union as a whole. Maybe that's not surprising. There's a little bit more of an activist bent in some of these newer sectors, and they've kind of gotten the short end of the stick in many ways. And then finally, the remainder is made up of some of these folks from independent parts and from some of these other sectors. So that I think that's a helpful lay of the land, because then we can ask, what is the actual structure of UAWD in terms of how decisions are made and the actual organizing we do on the ground, right? The focus of UAWD is, as a rank and file caucus, is to actually go out and do shop floor organizing and actually, you know, bring the movement to democratize the union to the rank and file, because our belief, as I think is probably shared by many here, that it's simply not possible without the rank and file driving that and actually leading it from the bottom up. But, you know, we should also be clear, we don't have thousands of organizers in UAWB across the union yet. We've got some places, you know, auto plants where there's a bunch of people really driving and other places where there's no one. And Judy can talk about some of the repression she's experienced at her local and in her region that speaks to that. So one thing I'll say is that we have a steering committee that's elected by the membership as a whole. That steering committee does make quite a bit of the sort of decision and set the strategy, but we actually set strategy collectively at UAWB. And we do that you know, at annual meetings where we set strategy, but also at quarterly membership meetings. These are meetings where any member of UAWD can bring a resolution, and this has happened. If somebody has brought something that the leadership doesn't quite like, or that the leadership is split on, there's sort of different opinions, and when it's come to the floor, it's been decided by rank and file members in the caucus. And I think that's very exciting, and I actually think it kind of keeps us from some of the things that you might be worried could sort of bureaucratize UAWD itself. I was talking with some comrades last night about how you avoid this concern. When you're relating the leadership that you get elected, how do you avoid that permeating back into the caucus and having caucus leadership say, oh, well, we shouldn't do that. That's a little risky. Maybe the leadership won't like it. So one way, I think really the only way to do that is to have a bulwark against it by having rank and file members really be making the decision in the caucus. So I want to give one example of how I think this really impacted. You know, this wasn't just an abstract notion of democracy, how it actually impacted the course of the last year and how it's actually impacting the contract campaign right now. So when we set up our slate, so UAWB, you know, recruited the slate from amongst disparate sort of dissidents across the UAW, not really all of whom were really core members of UAWB. So I think that's an important thing. You know, UAWD is not an old caucus. Maybe this looks a little bit different than, let's say, the Caucus of Rank and File Educators here in Chicago at CTU, which, you know, maybe it looks like the beginning of that, but 10 years in, it's very different. We didn't have people that were experienced and could necessarily win positions like president of the UAW, who were also members of our caucus already. So what we did was we found some people within the caucus to run, but we also recruited some folks who maybe had some alliances or some commonalities with some of our caucus leadership, but we're not yet part of it. What we did was we had a membership resolution, and it was hotly debated. A few people within our leadership were very opposed to some of the things in this, but we decided that we would democratically endorse our slate through a process where every member got to participate and the final outcome would be a vote. And we would have a couple of things that we made clear. First is that the slate would be a part of UAWD, that the campaign would actually be run within UAWD. It'd be UAWD staff and leadership running the campaign committee, and that the campaign committee would be expected to report back to the membership at meetings. Okay, accountability is kind of a hard term. I hope there's some debate about it later, because what it meant in practice was not necessarily all that much. What did accountability look like? There wasn't much we could really do if we didn't like the direction things were headed, but there was discussion, and it kind of allowed for that discussion. The other thing we did was we said that all of the people on our slate had to join UAWD, even if they weren't already members. And that meant, you know, again, some kind of minimal mechanistic things. They got added to our Slack, where, you know, all hundreds of auto workers are kind of chatting about what they think. They got added to some of our active WhatsApp groups, you know, where any member can just say, hey, I'd like this to happen more. And at the time, I was like, okay, this might actually just be symbolic. They might just end up being members of our caucus, but in name only. At the end of it, I don't think it's like, now they're vibrantly like core members who like all they do is live and breathe UNWD. That's not the case. But what it has meant is that Sean Fain, in particular, actually comes to our meetings, not everyone, but the ones where there's a big decision being made, and he actually ends up interacting with a lot of rank and file members. Now, it's not the case that we've taken votes to try to instruct Sean. There might be people who think that is the right strategy. I share some of those sympathies. I'd love to hear if people agree. But what we have done is actually been able to express what we'd like and push him on a couple of things that he might not have otherwise done. And before I wrap up, I'll just name a couple of those. One is this push recently to have practice pickets, and not just have practice pickets that were run by local leadership, who Judy will talk about how they blocked a lot of this effort, unfortunately. And there was a reluctance sort of to just send out directly to the rank and file, hey, you should organize practice pickets. But after sort of a bunch of people called for this within UAWD, posted in chats, Sean actually responded. It's kind of this funny back and forth. He actually sent an email out to all UAW members in the Big Three that said, we want you rank and file members to organize practice pickets. The other thing that we'll talk more about is this call for 32 for 40, a 32-hour work week for 40 hours pay, which is something that UAWD prioritized at our strategy meeting at the beginning of the year, and we've called for a while, and now Sean has taken that up after we made space and sort of built the political capital for that. He's now made that a top rallying cry. Yeah, thank you.
Sure. I've been in the union for 40 years. I actually still don't know what the regional director does, but I'm truly. And the regional director has power to control and inform 50,000 plus members at this point. So my local 600, which is the Big River Rouge complex and other affiliates, Ford, has actually taken the position that they will not do certain things unless the regional director tells them to. And that includes, like, part of this question is what's different about since Sean got elected? Well, what's different is that some of us are wearing these t-shirts, you know, no concessions, no corruption, no tears, which you all know, of course, new hires hire in at half pay and with no health care or pension when they retire. So, yes, and they're over half the workforce now. So there is hope to actually make a change if we can overcome their fears, and that is really the main issue here. But in any case, the like I was saying, the local officers block stuff. Another reason how the way they block stuff is that these cards are literally to sign up to, it's an international effort. It's the international putting out these cards, asking people to sign up to get the emails and the texts, because we're Andrew, just to correct Andrew, the international does not have permission to send email to a member without them signing this card. They don't get the emails or the text without signing this card, or they could go to uaw.org, which is, that's good because, see what my local says, and there was actually a unit president that got up and said, these are a plot by UAWD, don't sign. So, but none of the local officers said, no, just go to uaw.org, because they don't, well, you know, they don't want that. So that's that. And this is in a union where the membership is the highest authority in the local. So, trying to start my time again. Yes. So that's the whole middle level, and if you of the union. So the problem is, most members think that the international president basically is God, right, and can determine whether the sun rises and sets. This is apparently not the case, as we are finding out, the regional director. So, and locals apparently have a whole bunch of stuff. So, on drawbacks, one failure, I would say, of Sean, and this affects the workers. A worker will tell you in a heartbeat, and pretty much anybody in Detroit will tell you in a heartbeat, that the work went to China. Now, this is more than debilitating, because you know, are we going to fight China to get the work? Is it, you know, they're not even thinking, is it true that it went to China? So if any of you know economists or anybody that can research this, I would like all the information about how the work did not actually go to China, because, you know, they need that. But unfortunately, Sean has actually said in a presentation, work went to China. And you only have to say it once, and it's literally like kicking the dog. They never forget. And anyway, it's been being said for years. And just to get into the fears, that are promoted in the local, and it is the capitalist line, we must be competitive. Our plant will close, especially if we strike or if we vote no. You never get back what you lost during a strike. I'm sure a lot of you union people have heard this, right? Scabs will take your job. And my favorite is the top officer in my local 600 said on Sunday, that it, the NLRA, the National Labor Relations Act, makes it illegal to reveal details of the bargaining committee, the negotiating committee. It's illegal. And he was actually quite hysterical when he said that. We can't do this. So, and I think, do I have anything else I need to say?
Well, I appreciate you sharing. I think talking about the regional and the local director, I think, is a really helpful way to recognize that there is so much in between the president of UAW and the rank and file members. And so just electing the president of the UAW doesn't get to the fact that there is so much organizing and democratizing to happen in between. So I appreciate you highlighting that, Judy.
Yeah, and if I could just add like a little of the like, the sort of, to give a breadth of the bureaucracy. So there's about 550 people employed by the UAW. I think Judy got at this. A lot of these people are appointees, but not by like the sitting president. So that would be this notion maybe that there's real supremacy. The president changes the entire bureaucracy. That might be a bad thing too. That's also top-down unionism. But we're in sort of an even worse situation maybe where most of these appointees are appointees basically for life. And so what we have right now is this set of local presidents Judy talked about and this huge staff, which is quite loaded because of a lot of corruption and a lot of people getting put on staff over the decades, that is completely beholden to what we call the administration caucus, the old leadership who have been the sort of single party state of the UAW for basically 70 years since Walter Reuther. He was the founder of it. And so it's this really tough situation where we've got a rank and file movement from below, and we've got Sean Fain doing some pretty great and radical things from above, but then this huge middle layer that, like Judy said, is literally not doing the most basic thing of just handing out cards to get people's information. So it's really blocking fundamental aspects of what you would call a contract campaign. And I think that's the weird conundrum we're in. The top and the bottom still have to push through a huge bureaucracy to get almost anything done.
And I'm gonna add one more thing. The regional director is the only elected person sitting at the regional office. And she or he appoints people to handle the third stage grievances of the big three. So if I file a grievance and it gets to stage three, the ruling person there is the staff person from the region. And nobody knows this. I mean, I only found out, you read the contract carefully, it's in there. But, most people, again, think that the president is God.
Right. So I think we're now starting to get actually into the role of decision making here, since we understand that democracy is not realized just through electing individuals within the union. And so I want to ask Andrew and Judy next, how has UAWD politicized union decision making in order to begin building a stronger fighting union? And how does this or could this advance the socialist strategy? And Judy, I think we'll go to you first.
Okay. Well, UAWD has done a whole lot. I mean, Sean Fain really does come on Facebook, and for those people that know about Facebook, he really does say 32 for 40. He really does explain why that's a good idea. He really does explain why we need to get rid of all the tiers. Now, of course, the fear in the plant is the phrase, we can't get that all back in one contract. I mean, these are young and old workers I talk to that say that. And we have to break that down. And UAWD is trying hard to break that down. But we're not in these locals, mostly. So we need help. if you know somebody that knows somebody. So the other thing about UAWD, it does have a decision-making process. It is a democratic organization, quarterly meetings, correct, generally. And we also sponsor trainings, like you can get on YouTube and learn how to have a 10-minute meeting in your plant, for instance, to explain to people, which is, the idea of getting people in your plant to, talk about issues and teaching people to become organizers. So, moving, however, I am a communist or a socialist, right? And that's one reason I went to work in the plant and, of course, ended up fighting purely for reforms and being told a lot of lies about. But the main issue to me is, rather than keep this merry-go-round, where somebody gives up something 20 years ago and you don't get it back, and may have to go on a long strike to get any of it back. I would rather at least quietly be introducing a constant drip of somewhat socialist ideas, you know, or at least ideas that will indicate that something could be different. And those are often called transitional demands, which, you know, are the, you know, the idea that Marx and Trotsky talked about them, simply that these are demands that can't be fully realized under capitalism. And 32 for 40 is one of those, because some people may get that, but, you know, people like, you know, hotel cleaners aren't going to get it, right? You know, like, depending on where you are on the picking order. So that emphasizes solidarity. The other thing is, of course, it is actually a transitional demand to demand a worker solidarity across borders. And if any of you come to Detroit, you will see the Ford headquarters actually has all the flags of all the countries they're in. And, but, you know, again, American workers don't know that the German workers in at Ford in Germany would, you know, work 3 months a year less than we do. I mean, they don't know by law people have 5 and 6 weeks vacation. How am I doing on time? Is it?
No, you've got
more time. Okay. Trying to look at my hopeless notes here. Well, one issue really is in terms of the demands still are top down. Okay, but Sean Fain did, you know, in other words, the UAW, the official UAW, even before Sean, did ask for you to present demands, but that's the last you hear or see of it. And if you even remember what you put in, you're a miracle. But the main thing is Sean also was proposing, you know, at least some discussion, but it was never really able to come to fruition. So, you know, the idea of the democracy within this and updating and emphasizing or, you know, raising expectations, it didn't happen. But again, I would say this is not totally Sean's fault because he only just got in and he still has that complete mental bureaucracy against him. So that's what we're fighting for, is democracy, and at least the socialists in UAWD, and not everybody's a socialist. But we are fighting to at least have some impact as socialist ideas within the, because we have cred. Okay, I have cred. Okay, I was a union rep in the UE. I was organizer of an 1199 union. I got elected to the Tool and Die Executive Board at Local 600 several times by guys, right? I mean, you know, because Tool and Die has a dissident reputation, so the fact that I was putting out vote no leaflets at contract time means a lot to them. But so there is a level of cred, and what are you going to, you've got to develop the cred. But once you have that, do something with it. Don't hide your light under a bushel. All right.
Thanks, Judy. So, yeah. So I really like this question about how, you know, UAWD, and I think we should ask it about rank and file caucuses in general, has politicized union decision making. And I think, to Judy's point, that doesn't yet mean even democratizing union decision making, right? So we did not have a mass membership meeting in the Big Three to decide what our contract demands would be. You know, we're far from that stage yet. It might be something that we could get to, but we'd have to push, and there'd have to be a drive to actually be excited about that kind of thing. I think one thing we have done, though, and all that is to say, that's advancing socialist strategy, but certainly not realizing anything like socialism yet, and that's obviously not something yet that most rank and file workers even have on the radar, much less actually want. But all that said, we can still start moving in that direction and build a more militant union and actually take on more militant demand. I think we've shown that. So I'll give one other example, I think, of how the sort of democratic nature of our caucus has then been able to push the leaders that we've chosen to endorse to take more militant demands themselves and actually change the structure of the union. So I'm a part of what's called Region 9A, which has some manufacturing workers. So this is before I moved to Detroit, this is on the Northeast. It's mostly higher education workers and mostly legal services workers. Then there's some healthcare workers, there's some manufacturing workers, but it's probably 80% these sort of these newer industries for the UAW. That has a somewhat more radical character in some ways, although there's also a lot of workers who are just pretty disinterested in their union at all. So I wouldn't say on a some sort of left-right spectrum it's obvious where we are. I'd say there's actually a lot more militancy in the big three who will just walk out and stay out on strike for months if called to do so, despite the fact that there might be a more top-down sort of orientation there. So within our region 9A, we endorsed somebody who's actually supposed to be on this panel, and unfortunately didn't hear, Brandon Mancia, former president that I got to know over many years at the Harvard Graduate Students Union. He had been somebody who'd been a core member of our caucus going into the endorsements. He'd been a president, he had experience, and he wanted to run for this. So we sort of looked inward into our caucus, even though we were just developing the idea that we would have a UAWD 9A space. And we said, Brandon, do you want to run? You know, we'd be interested and excited to endorse you if so. We had an endorsement process across all of UAWD, and we did ultimately endorse Brandon. As part of that, what we as rank and file organizers within the region said is, Brandon, we're excited about you. We think you've got a great vision, but we'd like to actually collectively determine your platform. We'd like to have the UAWD 9A members who are going to be campaigning for you, who are going to be organizing in their locals, build the platform with you, not separately from you, not in opposition to you, of course, but with you. Brandon was excited about that, and we set out to have a process over a period of weeks to actually go through what would be on his platform. And some issues were contentious. There is a left-right division, you know, of sorts, even within our sort of higher ed-focused region. There were some more radical demands that some people were uncomfortable with. One of the things that was, I would say, a more radical demand that got watered down a bit but fundamentally stayed in was the idea that we would have what you now call a rank-and-file assembly within the region. So most unions in general, in the U.S., probably in the world, but certainly in the UAW, as Judy was saying, these regional structures and these kind of medium-level bureaucratic structures in the union are completely dominated by whoever is elected. Usually that person is of the old guard, and then these staff reps that they've appointed. That's how it is in the UAW, and that's still primarily the structure of the UAW, unfortunately. But this was an intervention to move away from that, to not just have a caucus space where Brandon and, you know, maybe 40 or 50 other people would actually talk about decisions, but to actually have a broad rank and file space across the entire region, a site of contestation where, you know, maybe our caucus members would be there organizing, but it would be an open space with mostly non-caucus members where we would actually get to tug things and actually try to pull things towards a more radical set of ideas. The idea that Brandon might have to give up some of his sort of power in a sense, actually something Brandon was less concerned by, but some members in our caucus were like, whoa, is that okay? And they're like, it's not only okay, it's wonderful. We're gonna try to democratize this region. So we put that in the platform, we talked about what that'd be, and then actually after we got elected, we set out to draft, like, what would the sort of rules of this space be? What would it look like? What would it likely like to have a mass sort of membership meeting, in a sense, at this regional level where there's 50,000 or so people? Obviously, we're not getting thousands of people yet to our meetings because we are underdeveloped and demobilized in many ways, but we're getting hundreds. And I think that's already been this exciting opportunity to now actually start prioritizing demands and debating, what do we want this sort of sector in higher ed, and what do we want this regional body, and fundamentally the staff of the region, what do we want them to prioritize? There's still contention over like how the decision should be made and who's making the decision, but I'll give one example of a decision that's actually coming up. So we're gonna have it's only our third rank and file assembly meeting coming up in 2 weeks. And something that's emerged as a top issue that many of us in UAWD are pushing for is to have a region-wide COLA campaign, inspired very much by the big three workers who are themselves having a fight to restore COLA. But in many of our higher ed and newer local unions, we've never had a COLA. These are just very sort of, you know, early unions that started at a time when labor was weak, and we're told by the UAW staff, unfortunately, COLA was impossible. Don't even fight for it. So there's basically no COLA in the entirety of higher ed in the UAW.
It's possible not everybody in the room knows what a COLA is.
Sorry, thank you. So COLA is a cost of living adjustment where your wages would be increased in addition to a pay increase that would come as a raise. They would be pegged additionally to that, either to inflation or maybe to the increase of housing costs, but some other metric that would keep real wages from being sort of depressed. So anyway, the upshot of the story is, by actually having a democratic relationship with our elected official and being in the driver's seat of actually getting to create the program along with that official, we've now created an entire new body in the union that is able to mobilize the actual staff and bureaucratic sort of side of the union to doing things like fighting for a region-wide COLA, which is something that simply wasn't possible in the past. And you could argue that maybe this also could have happened top-down. It also could have happened by having, you know, Brandon at the new director simply say we're going to do this. But the failure there might have been, it might have been successful, but might have been that there simply wouldn't have been enough rank and file members interested in actually organizing for that at their locals. So by doing this democratically, we've now engaged a large swath of people. There's still more organizing to go, but I think that's the vision of what I think a rank and file caucus can do within a year.
Thanks for listening. If you liked this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.